released without censorship, without redactions. And this is a law that really is very important. Now that it's been fully implemented by, ironically, Donald Trump, you know, it's a law that creates a new standard and a new precedence for openness and transparency. And it's very important that now that we have that standard, we apply that standard to the very administration that is in power today.
And it's interesting that while he's released the JFK files, the Shabazz family is asking for the release of the Malcolm X files, which he has yet to do. Peter Kornbluh, in the last 30 seconds, I wanted to get your response to President Trump basically also shuttering Voice of America and Radio Marti, particularly the news, if you could call it that, agency that was broadcasting into Cuba U.S. propaganda.
Well, he has shuttered the Cuba programs. USAID had Cuba democracy programs, which were very objectionable to the Cubans. Those are gone now. Radio Marti, TV Marti, gone now. That does not mean that Trump is not going to be pressuring Cuba in other ways. But at least the Cuba programs are gone. People who look closely at the Voice of America will know that they've used our documents in many stories that they've done. They, too, are not the Cold War product that they once were and had some value around the world.
We're going to have to leave it there, but we'll continue in a post show at democracynow.org. Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst for Latin America National Security Archive.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio.
You're listening to KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 4 special programming campaign. Check out all the great programs we're bringing you now through April 15th at kboo.fm/ATNF4.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Oregon Senate approves a bill authorizing unemployment for striking workers.
The Forest Park neighborhood has appealed the city's approval of a controversial power project.
And the London Heathrow Airport has shut down indefinitely following a catastrophic substation fire.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 21st, 2025. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Josh Salem. An Oregon bill designed to give striking workers access to unemployment benefits passed the state Senate on Thursday. Senate Bill 916 would allow workers in both the public and private sectors to access unemployment pay while they are actively on strike, with some limitations. The bill would require workers to be on strike for 2 weeks without pay before qualifying for unemployment. SB 916 would not include health benefits and includes provisions that would prevent workers from getting both unemployment benefits and back pay. After an hour of deliberation, the bill was passed by the Senate with a bare minimum vote, 16 out of the 30-member chamber. Advocates of the bill argue that the use of the unemployment pay would be relatively rare. But it would enable striking workers to wait out their employers in the bargaining process in order to win fair deals. That is especially important when bargaining with large corporations that have a financial advantage. Two Democratic senators dissented, stating concerns about how this would affect underfunded cities and counties. Republican senators unanimously opposed the bill and offered their own proposal. It would have required unions to create an internal fund for strikes lasting up to a month. If workers received unemployment benefits while on strike, they would have to pay them back with interest. The proposal also suggested that public employees be barred from striking. The Republican proposal was not passed. SB 916 now moves to the House.
Portland General Electric's plan to cut down over 300 trees in Forest Park faces another hurdle. The Forest Park Conservancy will appeal a Portland City Hearings officer's decision to allow the utility to fill in wetlands in order to increase their service capacity. KBOO's Hannah Francis has more on the story.
Last week, hearings officer Marisha Childs approved PGE's Harborton Reliability Project. In this process, they plan to cut and remove almost 400 trees, fill two wetlands that are home to at-risk northern red-legged tree frogs, and disturb ecosystems that Portland inhabitants have fought hard to preserve. The City of Portland's Permitting and Development Office itself recommended that this project be denied. Executive Director of Forest Park Conservancy, Scott Fogarty, plans to appeal Child's decision.
We think it is a very wrong decision by the hearings officer to allow PGE to remove nearly 5 acres of forest, wetlands, and streams from an ecological area that is slated to grow into an old-growth forest in the future, as per the Forest Park Natural Management Plan. We decided, as the Conservancy, it's part of our mission to steward the natural resources in the park, along with Portland Parks and Recreation, that we would oppose the hearings officer's decision and file an appeal to that. We are facing climate issues, not just in the Northwest, but in the country. And we've seen in this state and in other states where utility lines have created a tremendous fire hazard and have, you know, destroyed communities. And while that may sound extreme, it's a reality. And, you know, this project has the potential of creating an additional fire hazards in the face of climate change. And so, again, it's just another reason to oppose this. And as we understand, there are alternatives to their proposal. They're just a little more costly.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Hannah Francis.
The city of Lake Oswego must open its namesake lake to public access, according to a recent court ruling. The decision is the result of a years-long legal battle and has sparked controversy in the community. Members of the public had been banned for decades from swimming, fishing, or boating in the lake unless they owned lakefront property. Regular Lake Oswego residents had limited access, with a small area of the lake called a swim park open to them in the summer. The city council will decide whether or not to appeal the decision in the next few weeks. On Wednesday, the city's Parks Advisory Board passed a motion saying the city should let the ruling stand, arguing it was counterproductive to spend tax dollars fighting the right of Oregonians to use public resources. Lake Oswego Mayor Joe Buck released a statement yesterday calling out a common denominator in the conversation around lake access, specifically class. He said the city has received comments that, quote, express speculative fears of neighbors and othering of folks who either do not currently live in Lake Oswego or neighbors who just happen to not live along the lake itself, end quote. He pushes back on those comments saying, quote, we will not promote a safe community by gatekeeping, by rallying against access, be it via public transit or through parks, by limiting affordable housing, or by promoting fears of our brothers and sisters from across the region and even in our own backyard. He continued, quote, as mayor, I will not sit silent to comments that run counter to our community values and that promote the closing of our doors to any neighbor that wishes to be a part of our community as a resident, a visitor, a worker, or otherwise, end quote. If the city doesn't challenge the ruling, they'll have to open Millennium Plaza Park for public access, removing boulders and signs.
After more than a decade of planning and 2 years of construction, the Portland Art Museum's expansion is nearing completion. The museum announced on Thursday that it will open the Mark Rothko Pavilion, a brand new exhibition place, to the public on Thursday, November 20th, 2025. The Rothko Pavilion connects the two existing wings of the museum and will be primarily devoted to exhibiting the stark, iconoclastic works of its namesake. When the pavilion opens, visitors can walk freely between all four floors of both buildings for the first time. The pavilion is an open floor plan with minimal enclosure and long sight lines for visitors. Huge windows will saturate the exhibition space with natural light from the east and west, and new ADA accessible entrances will allow visitors to enter from either side. Previously, disabled visitors and large groups had to enter the museum via a ramp adjacent to the loading dock. The expansion, which also includes extensive renovations to both existing wings, is expected to cost $111 million. The Portland Art Museum will celebrate the opening with 4 days of festivities and special events in and around the museum.
Native communities and conservationists are calling on Washington Governor Bob Ferguson to support the Columbia Basin Restoration Initiative. It would direct federal, state, and tribal authorities to work together to restore fish populations and develop alternatives to dams for generating energy and shipping cargo. Mark Richardson has the story.
A coalition of conservationists and tribal nations is pushing for support of the Columbia Basin Restoration Initiative by state officials in Olympia. The initiative is a project to remove the Lower Snake River dams while maintaining current irrigation, transportation, energy, and recreation services. The initiative focuses on restoring salmon runs and supporting the endangered southern resident killer whales. Professional kayaker Gabe Newton will draw attention to the plight of the orcas next week. He says protecting them means protecting all living things.
Well, it's incredibly important. Every time a thread in the web of life is broken, our own capacity to thrive is diminished. And orcas and salmon are very integral threads.
Newton, who is also an artist and conservationist, will paddle 65 miles from Seattle to Olympia. He plans to meet with Governor Bob Ferguson and present 500 signed cards seeking his support. Former Governor Jay Inslee endorsed the initiative, but Ferguson, who took office in January, has yet to take a position. The initiative was first proposed by a group called the Six Sovereigns, including the tribes of the Yakima Nation, Umatilla Indian Reservation, Warm Springs Reservation, Nez Perce, and the states of Oregon and Washington. Newton says the kayak trip could be challenging.
It would be an easy run in the summer, but March is one of the windiest months of the year on the Puget Sound, and it tends to be the wind from the south, so I can expect a headwind most of the way, and depending on the strength of the wind, it could be treacherous or it could be mildly annoying.
Newton will also be one of the artists featured at an evening of art and poetry sponsored by the Save Our Salmon Coalition on March 26th in Olympia. For Washington News Service, I'm Mark Richardson.
After a lengthy debate, Portland City Council passed a resolution Wednesday night calling for an investigation into Houston company Zenith Energy. Specifically, the resolution calls for an investigation by the mayor's office into potential violations by Zenith Energy of their franchise agreement. It demands certain key actors, such as the director of Portland Permitting and Development, to disclose all their communications with Zenith Energy and their representatives during the latest application cycle. All pending applications and administrative actions relating to Zenith Energy are paused until the investigation is concluded. Lastly, the resolution directs the city auditor to investigate staff actions and communications with Zenith Energy and prepare a report for the city council. Some councilors expressed concern that investigating city employees would erode public trust in city government and damage the working relationship between city staff and city council. Despite these reservations, the resolution passed 11-1, with only District 3 Councilor Steve Novick voting against it. This investigation comes after almost a decade of public agitation, which began shortly after Zenith's arrival in 2017. City Councilor Mitch Green, who introduced the resolution, stated that passing this resolution was, quote, part of how we restore public trust, following the controversial approval of Zenith's latest application in February. Mayor Wilson's office approved that application despite a recent Department of Environmental Quality investigation which found substantial unpermitted construction at the site.
Care workers represented by SEIU Chapter 775 rallied this week in Yakima to demand federal lawmakers protect Medicaid funding. Isabel Charlet has the details.
This week, workers who provide in-home and nursing home care rallied against cuts to Medicaid. Washington's Medicaid, known as Apple Health, covers nearly 2 million low-income people in the state, including the majority of nursing home residents. SEIU 775 is the union that represents long-term care workers who assist seniors and people with disabilities in their homes and in nursing facilities. Adam Glickman with the union says caregivers help with such essential tasks as cooking, bathing, medication management, and transportation. He says cutting Medicaid would mean many wouldn't get the care they need.
That could mean they're left alone in their homes without care, For many people, it'll mean ending up in emergency rooms.
President Donald Trump and House Republicans are proposing $888 billion in cuts from the Energy and Commerce Committee, most of which would come from Medicaid. Critics say the goal of that plan is to help pay for tax cuts that would largely benefit the wealthiest Americans. Candy Liu is a caregiver and union member who depends on Medicaid for her own family's health care as well as for her income. Liu emigrated from China 40 years ago and thinks cuts to Medicaid would especially harm immigrant communities.
This is not just about the number, you know, it's about the real people. It's about the family, you know, like me, depending on the Medicaid to survive, right?
The Trump administration says Medicaid cuts would focus on reducing waste and fraud in the program. Glickman contends it's an issue that has been blown out of proportion.
I think this has become a red herring or kind of smokescreen by people who just really don't want to admit that what they're doing is cutting people's health care.
A new poll from the Kaiser Family Foundation confirms Medicaid's popularity across the country, with only 17% of Americans supporting cuts to the program. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
In national news, huge cuts to the Department of Education roil the nation. Trump's immigration crackdown hits legal roadblocks, and a bill outlawing certain voter roll purges hits the desk of the Virginia governor. With more on these stories, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The states are better for administering the programs. No one's talking about cutting Title I or Title IX or Title VII. It's about who's best to deliver the funds.
Montana Republican Congressman Ryan Zinke argues that states can better manage education programs. President Donald Trump is going ahead with promised moves to dismantle the Department of Education by executive action. A teachers union responded, quote, "See you in court." Without the agency, it's not clear what will happen to the federal role in special education, low-income student programs, and college grants. Education policy expert Josh Cowan of Michigan State University says the department already lost half its staff.
We're going to run into some pretty quick trouble pretty quickly if congressionally required payments to schools, states, districts, but ultimately serving kids and families in Michigan and elsewhere aren't met because of staff shortages.
A federal judge has halted White House efforts to deport alleged Venezuelan gang members under an 18th century law for use in wartime. Trump's call for that judge's impeachment brought an unusual rebuke from Chief Justice John Roberts. A separate federal judge has temporarily blocked the deportation of a detained Georgetown researcher. Badr Khan Suri has not been charged with a specific crime, but immigration officials accuse him of spreading Hamas propaganda. A third federal judge is blocking Elon Musk's advisory cost-cutting committee from accessing private Social Security Administration data. The judge said DOGE is searching for a needle in a very sensitive haystack without concrete evidence the needle even exists. Courts are also pushing back on administration actions regarding the rights of transgender individuals. Farmers say they're concerned that USDA grants are being canceled or delayed. Funds to reimburse farm investments or to pay for supplying food banks and schools have been frozen. South Dakota egg farmer Stephanie Peterson says their expansion plans are now stalled.
The pandemic showed us the fragility of our industrial egg system and how important it is to build up and focus on these regional and local systems.
The USDA has reinstated some funding, but not for local food initiatives described as non-essential. Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin faces a deadline to sign or veto a bill that would restrict last-minute voter roll purges before elections. Purges like that had been prohibited, but with those rules loosened, Youngkin signed an executive order last year, resulting in 6,000 voters being purged as non-citizens. Sheila Herlihy-Hennessy with the Virginia Interfaith Center for Public Policy says according to the DMV, many were legitimate voters who were then denied their rights. She says state lawmakers were correct to pass a bill addressing it.
This affects rural areas. This affects new Americans. This affects a lot of people around Virginia. And I want to see our legislators protect those individuals.
I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Then at 8, it's the ever-rambunctious Youth Randomium. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with infrequent drizzle and a low of 41. Scattered showers will continue throughout tomorrow with a high of 53. 100 years ago today, the Butler Act was signed into law in Nashville, Tennessee. That act prohibited school teachers from differing from or denying the truth of the biblical account of creation as written in the book of Genesis. It further barred school teachers from teaching the concept of evolution in Tennessee public schools. The law was the subject of the legendary Scopes Monkey Trial in July of that year. The quote of the day is from Clarence Darrow, attorney for the defense in the Scopes trial, who said, "Chase after the truth like all hell, and you'll free yourself, even though you never touch its coattails."
Native communities and the lawmakers that represent them are speaking out and taking action against the Trump administration's massive cuts to the U.S. Department of Education. With that story and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Educators and lawmakers are blasting President Trump's push to dismantle the U.S. Department of Education. Among them is the vice chairman of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs. In a release, Democratic Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii said the Education Department is part of the federal government's core trust and treaty responsibility to American Indians, Native Hawaiians, and Alaska Natives. Schatz says over 90% of Native students attend public schools who will be at the mercy of state governments that have no legal responsibility to meet needs. The elimination of the department would affect special education, language learner supports, and Title VI Indian education programs, among others. Furthermore, Native higher education would be affected, including funding for tribal colleges and programs administering federal loans and Pell Grants. Trump's rationale includes low academic scores during the pandemic. Neither Trump nor his staff have explained how ending the department would boost student performance. The Colorado-based Native American Rights Fund has filed a lawsuit challenging the Trump administration's efforts to cut U.S. Department of Education spending. The Mountain West News Bureau's Yvette Fernandez has more.
The nonprofit argues in U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C., that funding cuts are a violation of longstanding treaties between tribes and the U.S. government. Attorney Jacqueline DeLeon is leading the legal effort. She says cuts, including layoffs of about a quarter of the staff, were made without input from tribes.
The federal government has to consult with tribes before they make changes to education, including to staffing, and they have a responsibility to fulfill those education requirements separately and apart from policy decisions or politics.
The suit names two indigenous colleges, one in Kansas and the Southwestern Indian Polytechnic Institute in New Mexico. DeLeon says a ruling could affect schools across the American Indian Higher Education Consortium of 37 tribal institutions across the country, including those in Mountain West states. The Secretary of the Department of the Interior is named as the defendant in the suit and has not yet filed a response, according to court filings. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Yvette Fernandez.
Native American students in New Mexico will be able to wear their tribal regalia at graduation ceremonies this spring after Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham signed a bill into law on Wednesday. Reporter Jeanette DeDios has more.
Senate Bill 163 prevents school boards from banning tribal regalia at graduation ceremonies. The bill is a response to an incident that occurred last May in Farmington, New Mexico, where a Native American high school graduate was ordered to remove their graduation cap that had an eagle plume and beads. Despite some initial concerns from lawmakers, the bill passed unanimously through both chambers before being signed by the governor. Lujan Grisham says Native American students are at a higher risk of being bullied and committing suicide. And this bill encourages them to be proud of who they are and can help promote their well-being.
This is really about making sure that New Mexico stands on the right side of this civil rights issue and in the right side of kids.
New Mexico Secretary for the Indian Affairs Department, Josette Monette, is from the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa and says she's excited to see this year's graduates in their tribal regalia.
Shows New Mexico's dedication and respect for our Native students throughout the entire state.
Monette said her department plans to create a campaign that will collect pictures of this year's Native American students during their graduation ceremonies. Those will be shared on social media and other outlets to recognize the hard work of the students and the passing of this bill, which goes into effect immediately. For National Native News, I'm Jeanette Didios.
And yesterday, we reported on the disappearance of references to Navajo code talkers on U.S. military websites. We've learned since then that following widespread outcry, those references and webpages are back up. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull.
Confusion reigns for federal workers under the Trump administration. Some of the workers fired in the last 2 months are supposed to be rehired, according to a recent court order, but the legal battle is still unfolding. On January 20th, Trump canceled every federal DEI program and fired all government employees associated with diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives in line with Project 2025. In February, on the 26th, Trump's administration began firing workers hired within the last year, who were officially called probationary employees. More than one judge has ruled the firings to be illegal. U.S. District Judge William Alsup said the mass firings were part of a, quote, sham strategy to shrink government, while avoiding legal requirements to guide reductions in the federal workforce. Trump is challenging the ruling in court. The U.S. federal government has seen its workforce shrink by over 24,000 persons under Trump and unelected advisor Elon Musk, who Trump has put in charge of the Department of Government Efficiency. After a federal judge's order last week, most of the terminated workers at 18 federal agencies are in the process of being rehired. The workers are supposed to be placed on paid administrative leave while the appeals process unfolds. If the courts rule in their favor, they will be expected to repay any unemployment benefits collected during their short period of termination. The workers may not return to their jobs, however, unless the Trump administration loses its appeal of the rehiring process.
London's Heathrow Airport, the world's fifth busiest airport, closed down early this morning after a catastrophic fire at its electrical substation. Heathrow Airport said it doesn't know when power will be restored and that it expects several days of disruption. The entire airport will remain closed until at least midnight tonight. A transformer at an electrical substation in the West London suburb of Hayes caught fire just before midnight on Thursday. Residents in West London described a large explosion at the substation followed by a fireball and clouds of smoke. The fire, which took 7 hours to control, also knocked out a backup power supply to the airport. The London Fire Brigade sent 10 engines and some 70 firefighters to control the blaze, and 150 people living near the substation were evacuated from the area. Firefighters managed to get the blaze under control by Friday midday, but Heathrow's service remains halted until power is safely restored. An airport statement said, quote, "Passengers should not travel to the airport under any circumstances until the airport reopens," end quote. Counterterrorism police are leading the investigation into the cause of the fire. A spokesperson for London's Metropolitan Police said, quote, "While there is currently no indication of foul play, we retain an open mind at this time," end quote. Heathrow transported 83 million passengers last year. It is a vital component of the British economy and is a major hub for travel across Europe.
Are heat pumps the answer to our climate challenges? Dr. Anthony Leisowitz dips his toes into this somewhat burning question on today's episode of Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When you turn on the faucet to take a shower, you just want the water to be warm. You don't want to think about what kind of energy was used to heat it. But utilities do. As electric heat pump water heaters gain popularity, some utilities in the West are testing technology that can adjust the time these devices use electricity to when there's more clean energy on the grid.
Heat pump water heaters are really easy to control.
Wesley Whited is with DNV, a global consulting firm. He says this can be done while still maintaining residents' comfort.
residents have really predictable hot water use patterns. So think about your morning routine. We're using a lot of hot water in the morning as we're getting our families ready for school and ready for work, but we're not having a lot of high hot water demand, say at 1 p.m. And that is actually the time when we have a lot of excess renewable energy on the grid.
The approach can help consumers save money because they're shifting their energy use to times when it's more abundant and cheaper. And it can help the grid use more clean energy, which reduces carbon pollution. So Whited says he's excited about the technology.
From a climate perspective, heat pump water heaters are really going to be a hero of the future energy transition.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Now we go to The Point Puzzle, the weekly radio brain teaser produced by Pearl Stark at KPOV Bend. On this week's puzzle, wordplay and spring weather.
It's time for the puzzle.
Last week, I asked you to send me a bird with a silent first letter. If you pronounced the first letter instead of the second one, phonetically, you might be asking for more cheese. Well, the answer is ptarmigan, which becomes ptarmigan. Our winner this week is Yana Stanek, who listens to KBOO in Portland, Oregon.
Flying birds. Excellent birds. Watch them fly.
There they go. Well, I thought we were getting spring here in Bend, but then it started to snow again this weekend, which really describes spring weather after all. So, take the first two-thirds of a sign of winter, add an I and O, followed by the last third of a sign of spring, to get a synonym for unpredictable. So again, take the first two-thirds of a sign of winter, add an I and O, followed by the last third of a sign of spring, to get a synonym for unpredictable. When you have the answer, send your name, your answer, and the station on which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org. I'll select one winner from among any answers received by this Saturday.
And drove our old spring wagon through the hills near Edmonton. When a cold winter shadow...
This has been Pearl Stark with your Point Puzzle for the week of March 17th. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV, High Desert Community Radio.